to say that I almost feel like I don't need to preach. I could just let you guys sing Down by the Riverside. You guys sounded great. Well, as I mentioned to the kids, today's service is meant to focus on two things. First, today is Peace Sunday because the United Nations has designated today to be the International Day of Peace. And of course, I like to think that every Sunday is Peace Sunday at Montclair Presbyterian Church. But it also seems good and appropriate to speak of peace on this Sunday when people all around the world are joining us in that conversation. The other thing, though, is that I've made a commitment of sorts to preach a sermon on earth care at least once a quarter. And I'm trying to place these sermons sometime near the equinoxes and the solstices. Well, today we have what the Birkenstock-wearing, crystal-adorned, hempen-clad practitioners of grooviness who were my elementary school teachers and my Little League coaches back in the days of my Mendocino childhood. Today, we have what they would have called an harmonic convergence. It's Peace Day and it's the equinox. Wow, man. So I want to talk to you about how I believe peace is inherently connected to earth care, particularly as it relates to climate change. But before I do, I feel as if I should address a nagging voice that whispers in the back of my mind every time I, as a clergyman, speak of peace and of earth care. What right have you to speak? The voice asks. You are a Christian. You wear a bow tie and penny loafers. Until a year ago, you had a Republican haircut. No one starts more wars than religious folks who, by the way, also believe they gave them the earth to do with as they please. Isn't it the Christians who are saying, damn the smell, full speed ahead, drain the delta? Well, my response to those nagging questions, that nagging voice in my head, is as follows. I'm afraid the suspicion goes both ways. As a person of faith, I cannot set aside my malarkey monitor and follow the lead of secular peace and environmentalist movements without asking questions. And I'll tell you why. There's a spider walking across my head. I don't know if the spider was trying to tell me something, but I think it's happy on the floor. Yeah, anyway, I'm as suspicious of the secular peace and environmentalist movements as they are of me, I think. You know, when I was in college, I spent 3 summers working for a group of small rural Presbyterian congregations in Humboldt County. That, by the way, is where I met Karen Stokes, a former minister here at this church. And the second summer that I spent in Humboldt County was a summer of wild and sometimes violent protests and counter-protests. It was called Redwood Summer. What happened is an organization called Earth First organized and agitated around saving old-growth redwood groves from logging, and they brought in people from all over the world to join them as they demonstrated in various places and in various ways. And I went to one of those major protests, which was staged in front of a paper mill on Samoa Island across Humboldt Bay from Eureka. It was crazy. On one side of a police line that included every law enforcement person available, including the Arcata dog catcher. On one side of that police line, there was a wild assortment of countercultural types who were yelling and spitting at the cops and demanding an end to the logging of redwood forests. On the other side of the police line were timber industry types who tended to be dressed in steel-toed boots and plaid shirts and billed caps, and they were shouting profanities at their countercultural counterparts, telling them to go back to the city and to stop taking their jobs away. Here's the thing, though. Behind the loggers and mill workers demanding that their timber industry jobs be preserved was a ship that, during the protest, was it there at the dock being loaded with raw timber that was going to be sent to Asia to be milled by folks willing to work for a fraction of what Californian mill workers were willing to get paid. And as the environmentalists were protesting the logging of redwoods, a logging truck drove up headed to the paper mill. The protesters seized the truck, forcing the driver out of the cab. They then chained themselves in a circle around the truck and its trailer, thereby scoring a victory for the redwood forest, except that there wasn't a single redwood log on the truck. It was all tan oak headed to the pulp mill to be turned into paper. The protesters evidently didn't know a tan oak from a redwood. And apparently they hadn't heard that removing tan oak and other hardwoods is one of the very best things you can do to help redwood forests recover after logging. I came away from that experience suspecting that the good intentions of those who wanted either to preserve the forest or save jobs had been hijacked by people who simply wanted to spew invective at those who looked different. People in VW vans wanted to hate the folks in 4x4s, and the folks in pickups were all too happy to return the favor. As a person of faith, I am unable to be part of that dogpile of animosity, which I think continues somewhat today in the ways we talk about things like climate change. Only now it's SUV versus Prius. And don't get me wrong, I am deep in those arguments. But my faith tells me that I should be committed to caring for God's creation because it is necessary and good, not because it's a way of thumbing my nose in the general direction of Texas. The other response to the nagging voice in my head has to do with the idea that religion and religious people are responsible for most, if not all, of human conflict. I have lots of responses to that. Some of them are thoughtful. You know, I like to say that religion is appropriated by violent people but does not itself cause war. And some of the responses are, you know, frankly more in your face and a little bit snarky. I like to point out that in the 20th century, atheism had lots of opportunities to show that it was more peaceable than religion, but Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot, and Castro proved that atheism could kill even better than religion. In the end, whether you're talking about animosity between environmentalists and loggers up behind the redwood curtain, or the violence of Soviet purges, conflict usually is not caused by religion or ideology. Sometimes it is, but much more often, conflict is caused by scarcity. When stands of old-growth redwood become scarce, conflict arises around what to do with the remaining trees. When crops fail and hunger sets in and folks start to rise up against totalitarian power structures, the state responds with violence. When oil is scarce, the consumers of oil are willing to kill and to cause all kinds of collateral damage to preserve the smooth flow of crude. And that, finally, is a good segue into climate change. My guess is that almost all of us here understand the basic problems with climate change. In fact, some of you understand it far better than I do. But here is the basic issue as I understand it. All of us burn fossil fuels like coal, gasoline, and natural gas. Fossil fuels provide us with electricity. They make our internal combustion engines move, which enables our transportation. They keep us warm in the winter. Many of us also eat beef, which is from cows, which are insanely prolific dispensers of methane gas, which doesn't help one bit. When we burn fossil fuels, we release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, which, for reasons that I don't entirely understand, traps the sun's heat, as does methane gas, which makes the Earth's surface warmer. And in a warmer Earth, all kinds of really undesirable stuff happens. Much of it involves melting ice. There is an insane amount of water stored in the Arctic Sea, the Arctic ice caps, both on the North and in the South Poles. As I understand it, a mountain range the size of the European Alps lies underneath Antarctic ice. That's a lot of water. And if even a portion of that ice melts, the sea levels will rise in ways that will displace more than 1 billion people. Not only that, but 10 major rivers flow out of the glaciers in the Tibetan Plateau, including the Yangtze River, the Yellow River, the Indus River, the Ganges River, the Mekong River. Almost half of the planet's population lives in the watersheds of these rivers, and the glaciers that feed these rivers are melting. If the glaciers disappear, it will cause scarcity, the likes of which the world has never known. First, the rivers will flood as ice melts at an abnormal rate, and this is already happening. You may remember severe flooding in Pakistan a few years ago. And then, when the ice is gone, the rivers will shrink, and there will not be enough water to irrigate the fields that are the principal source of nutrition, and therefore of life, for more than 3 billion souls. And this says nothing of fisheries, of drinking water, of transportation, of electricity, all of which come out of these rivers. These melting glaciers in the Tibetan Plateau, when they melt, will cause huge problems. In fact, the melting glaciers in the Tibetan Plateau give us a recipe for war. Believe me, if humans will go to war over oil, we will go to war over water rights and over access to food. And bear in mind that China, India, and Pakistan, three of the nations facing scarcity of water and by extension of food as the result of melting Tibetan ice, these are all nuclear powers. And nothing drives violence more than scarcity, which is why every time you choose to ride a bike or take public transportation instead of driving a car, every time you install solar panels on your home or on your church, God bless you people of NBC, you're not just saving the earth or preventing erratic weather patterns we associate with global warming. When we wean ourselves from our dependence upon fossil fuels, we are saving lives. We are preventing bloodshed and suffering because we are working to preserve the earth's abundance. But what does Christianity have to offer? What does our faith tradition have to say in all of this? Well, I believe part of the answer is found in a way that is articulated rather nicely in this morning's lesson from the book of the prophet Amos, which starts with the sound of a pulpit thumping in words that are eerie to speak before preaching about peace and climate change. God is going to melt the earth. God is going to call for the waters of the sea to bring them up and pour them on the land. But what follows are words that challenge us to see beyond ourselves. These words are spoken to people complaining about their suffering, in part because they believed that they had a monopoly on God's favor, and because they thought God loved them uniquely, they couldn't figure out why God allowed them to suffer. In response to this complaint, the prophet says, "Are you not like the Ethiopians to me, O people of Israel? Did I not bring Israel out from the land of Egypt and the Philistines from the land of Caphtor? And the Arameans from Kir?" "Sure," says God through the prophet, "I saved you in the past. But I also saved other people, including your bitter enemies, the Philistines. I saved them too. You are my people, but so are the Ethiopians, and so are the Arameans." I believe this passage calls us to look beyond ourselves, to understand that the lives of other nations on other continents matter to God. And that's not easy. What's easy, what comes naturally to most of us, is the idea that we're special, that our need to consume lots of fossil fuels is more important than the political stability of nations halfway around the globe. Now, if we take the message from Amos this morning seriously, it means we must consider not just what is good for us, but also what is good for others. This is a concept articulated by Lou Mudge in his book, We Can Make the World Economy a Sustainable Global Home. Lou called it stakeholdership. If we're going to be peacemakers, and if we're going to heal the earth, we must understand that we are not the only stakeholders in our economic decisions. If we clear-cut stands of old-growth redwood, we're not just providing temporary jobs for loggers and mill workers, and we're not just providing profit for the global corporations who now own all the lumber companies in Northern California. Rather, we are destroying the habitat for several species, including the salmon. And when we destroy the salmon spawning grounds, we destroy the fishing industry, which eliminates jobs and takes food off of tables, making us more reliant upon beef, which comes from cattle, which produce methane, which is a greenhouse gas, which causes climate change, which is melting glaciers in Tibet, which has the potential to cause mass famine in Asia, which is a recipe for violence, extreme violence. Now, I've simplified things somewhat. But the point I want to make is this. An economic decision in Northern California, the economic decision that asks whether or not we're going to log ancient forests, our answer to that question, that decision we make, has global consequences. And if we're going to be responsible, we will consider all of the stakeholders in our decision. The stakeholders who include the logger in Fortuna, the young girl selling samosas in the streets of Mumbai. For our God is a God of all creation. She is the God of the logger and the child in India. She is the God of the salmon and the cows, the God of glaciers and ice caps, the God of hippies and of every harmonic convergence. Ours is the God who calls himself Prince of Peace. Ours is the God of the climate change denier, and ours is the God of Bill McKibben himself. Ours is the God who calls us to understand that all God's children are stakeholders in one another's decisions. The God who claims us and calls us to remember whose we are. The God who leads us as we seek to save the earth and to be purveyors of peace.